What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. We are live for you on this Wednesday. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, do give us a call at 833-288-EWTN, especially if you really don't know where else to turn. That's why we're here. 833-288-3986. If you're listening to us outside North America, and we do have listeners all over the world, literally, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response. And once you get that response, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. Can you send us an email? Why, yes, you can. Here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Michael McCall handling the phone screening today. Rich Jesse is doing social media. And if you would like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, Rich is monitoring both those sites right now. Just put your question in the comments box. Rich will see it. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio, and that's how we get that question answered for you. Again, the phone number, 833-288-EWTN. Lines are wide open right now. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm very well. Are you staying hydrated this particular heat wave? I hope so.
I am hydrating.
Excellent. We're going to lead off with this fascinating, very basic question from Maris in Nebraska. Mara says, can you explain what the word religion means? I have repeatedly heard non-Catholics denigrate religion like it's some kind of a dirty word. How can I respond to Christians who have a negative attitude towards religion? Thanks, Maris in Nebraska.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, etymologically, religion comes from the Latin would mean to bind back or to tie together. And the way that shook out in history, I think, was the idea that the people owed the gods certain duties that would connect them to the divine, and they would satisfy those mandates, those obligations.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, obviously that practice can be more or less superstitious, and there have certainly been a lot of superstitious religions over the years. In Christianity, the idea developed, and also actually in pagan philosophy as well, that we have a moral obligation to render honors to the divine, to the transcendent, to that which is above us. And so St. Thomas considered religion to be the name of a virtue rather than a particular kind of practice. It would be the habit of rendering to God what is due. And again, that doesn't necessitate any particular concept of God. That could be consistent with a Christian concept of God, could be consistent with a very, you know, sort of pagan, superstitious, polytheistic concept. It could be something consistent with a much more philosophical, Platonic or Neoplatonic concept. But the idea that one has a kind of moral duty to the transcendent as such, right, is what like eventually became the sort of philosophical concept of religion. And it's one that I'm sympathetic to, right, that humans seem to be built. We're put together in a certain way that we have a sort of a desire for the transcendent. We find our fulfillment in things bigger than ourselves. And the crisis of meaninglessness that is oppressive and can lead to really dire psychological outcomes is, among other things, related to the idea of not having some sort of transcendent dimension to your life. When you think this is all there is, right, that can seem empty and meaningless to a person, and that can lead them into self-destructive behavior. So I do think the idea that there is a kind of natural virtue that orients us towards the transcendent, to that which is above and beyond us, to things that are greater than ourselves, is something that fundamentally contributes to human flourishing and doesn't frustrate it. And you know, it's hard to imagine reaching for the more and the greater and the better if we didn't have that kind of intrinsic drive. And so, sort of consistent with St. Thomas and the philosophical tradition, I would regard good religion as those habits of life and mind that facilitate that yearning and that straining for the transcendent good. And again, I don't think that necessitates a specifically Christian conception of the good. I think that, a pagan could have it like Plato, for example, or Socrates or somebody, or the great sages of the world traditions, to the extent that they pursue that which is truest, noblest, most beautiful in their own cultures according to their own lights, and do so in obedience to conscience. I'd say they were satisfying the natural virtue of religion, right? Now, you know, in the Enlightenment, it became popular to criticize religion as such. And so religion becomes a category, a social category of, you know, identified with the backward and the superstitious and the naive and this kind of thing. And there's a lot of that kind of religion. I mean, that's what the church would call superstition. Religion, you know, that response to that transcendent impulse that does not accord with reason. Right, that's what we would call superstition, and the Catholic Church actually regards superstition as a vice or a sin, and something to be avoided at all costs. And so, you know, the kind of polemics around religion. When I listen to new atheists like Christopher Hitchens or Dan Dennett or Richard Dawkins or somebody like that that are attacking quote religion end quote.
Yeah.
A lot of times I'm there agreeing with them. I'm thinking, yeah, I don't like those things in religion either, right, broadly conceived.
Yeah.
But that's not the virtue of religion as conceived by the Catholic Church or its luminaries like St. Thomas.
Thank you so much, Maris, in Nebraska, for your question. And, you know, sometimes, David, you hear the phrase organized religion, you know, and I think, well, you know, I'm not all that organized.
Oh, right. And I've worked in Catholic ministry enough to know that sometimes that would be a serious oxymoron as applied to Catholic activities. Sometimes it's disorganized religion.
But we just got to keep trying.
That's right.
That's all there is to it. And thank you so much for that question. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, here's that address again, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. We try to answer at least one, sometimes more than that, on every of our live shows. And then once a month or so, we'll grab the mailbag and kind of shake it and let all those emails come on out. And then we can answer a whole bunch of emails on a mailbag program, again, about once a month. So do keep them coming, ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we're going to talk with Lawrence in Raleigh, North Carolina. Also, Jack watching us on YouTube this afternoon. V is watching us on YouTube. A couple of great questions there. We'll get to those as well. That phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Wednesday afternoon on EWTN. It's called Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. We are live for you. Lines are open right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We are, of course, in the era of AI, artificial intelligence, the era of fake news. Where do you go? Where do you go when you want to get the truth? Well, I'll tell you where I go. Catholic News Agency. You can rely on CNA to cover the mission and activities of the Catholic Church, including social, political, moral, cultural issues from a perspective of faith. For all the latest Catholic news, visit CatholicNewsAgency.com. It's an online service from EWTN News. And by the way, you can now get timely email news updates from us. Visit EWTN.com. Click on the word subscribe. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Beginning today with Lawrence. Lawrence is in Raleigh, North Carolina, and listening on the iHeart app. Hello there, Lawrence. What's on your mind today, sir?
Mr. Anders, this is a follow-up question to what I asked some weeks ago.
Okay.
My question was about what is a scriptural basis, specifically the part of scripture covered by the lectionary for the church's social doctrine, and you cited prophets. And said that those are examples of social justice. However, I would say that there are more calls to personal action. What I mean, I when I say I see social doctrine of the church being used, for example, by Pope Francis to take positions on public policy, such as immigration. That's what I mean by, so what is the, why does the, I mean, you frequently say that the purpose of our faith is to transform our interior life and lead lives of virtue and charity. So why is the church, why does it involve itself in trying to influence public policy?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So you raised a couple of issues here, and one of them was the question at the outset about the foundation of the church's social doctrine, specifically in the lectionary. And I responded to that in a previous call to a certain extent. What I didn't challenge was the premise of the question, which I'm not sure what motivated the question, but it seems to suggest to me that for Catholics to take a particular doctrine seriously, they should find it in the lectionary. I mean, this seemed to be what you were implying. And if that's your thought, like let's say hypothetically there's some position that is not represented in the lectionary. Well, should Catholics therefore abandon that position? And I think that would be a deeply irrational thing to do. You know, I mean, the lectionary can't possibly address every moral or social or theological question that can occur to a Catholic, and limiting myself to the content of the lectionary seems like it's a more kind of a Protestant way of thinking about religious authority, that I have to find it, you know, in a determinate body of texts, or otherwise I'm not morally obligated to it. That's just wrongheaded from my point of view, and I think from the church's point of view. So you're absolutely correct that I think that the goal of the Christian faith, the Catholic faith, is to transform our interior lives. What I mean by that is what we think about, what we value, how we conceive of ourselves in the world, what motivates us, what attracts us. These are all aspects of our consciousness, and the aim of the faith is to transform our consciousness, right? That we come to live in the world in a different way, to see things in a different light, to value things in a different light. But unambiguously, from my reading, we are also social creatures. And so how we are to conceive ourselves in the world, the interior transformation that we are to undergo, is precisely one that has us come to regard the welfare of our neighbor as equal to our own. And that inevitably involves us in social questions. Now, you raised... in point of fact, when St. Paul addresses this in many places, but one of them would be his first letter to the Corinthians, he makes the social question the criterion for lawful participation in the Eucharist. He advances the charge that the Corinthians were ideologically and politically divided against one another, such that they tended to disregard their neighbors, and that behavior made their communion unfruitful and, in fact, spiritually dangerous. Right? So I think it's deeply embedded in the church's liturgy, if you will. So there you go.
There you go. Lawrence, thanks so much for your call.
I know what I was going to say.
Yeah,
last part was about policy.
Okay.
Right?
Oh, okay.
So there's a difference between the church's social doctrine and political policy. And even Francis acknowledged this difference, but John Paul II made it quite explicit in one of his social encyclicals, Solicitudo Rei Socialis is the name of the encyclical, in which he says that we should not confute the Catholic Church's social doctrine with any political ideology or the policies that would flow from that, right? Because the church's doctrine is not on the left side of the political spectrum, it's not on the right side of the political spectrum, it's not in the middle. That's the whole thing is a category mistake. It's not on that continuum at all.
Right.
It's another category. And so what the church does is it prescribes for us, in general terms, the conditions of human flourishing. And those would be social and individual. But it is up to policymakers to attempt to apply those abstract principles to concrete historical circumstances. Since concrete historical circumstances can change radically from century to century and country to country, it would be very unwise for the church to prescribe a single set of policy solutions that, as if they would answer to any possible situation. That's just not how culture and society and demographics work.
Yeah.
And the fact that every one of us has a kind of narrowness of vision and a difficulty in taking the big picture and making prudent choices, it's almost always going to be the case that ideological positions and policy decisions are procrustean. That is to say that they are going to lop off the bits of empirical experience that don't fit in order to force them into the theory, and they have a tendency to be dehumanizing in consequence. I mean, take as an example the ideology of free market capitalism that will inevitably overconstrue man as an economic agent, and tends in the very construction of the theory to ignore man as a spiritual animal, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be the case, for example, that free market capitalism is the most efficient way to distribute goods throughout the society that leads to the greatest degree of economic growth. Is that the only criterion of human flourishing? Well, you know, this is a certain kind of capitalist ideologue that would answer the question yes, and thus ignore the spiritual dimension of human personality.
Sure,
so that's what I mean by procrustean, right? But because of that, when I'm a Catholic layperson and I'm evaluating, say, a statement by the magisterium, I'm going to distinguish in my own mind those universal abstract truths of man's moral nature that would form the basis of the church's social doctrine from the particular political ideology of some church office holder, even if it's the Pope. And I'm obligated to hold the one, and I'm not obligated to hold the other. So it can happen that your priest or your bishop or your pope makes a sort of blatantly ideological policy prescription. That does not obligate me as a Catholic to always follow them in that. All I am obligated to do as a Catholic is, with such statements, is to grant them a kind of religious submission of mind and will. What that means is I don't have to assent to them. I have to say, well, you know, he's the pastor of the church and I'm not.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's take a local parish, and the parish has got a budget and is trying to decide how it's going to spend its money. And there's one party in the church that says, well, we want to put this money behind the local Catholic pro-life agency. And there's another party that says, no, we got all that we need. We need to put this behind this, there's a march over here that's taking place in the state capitol against the death penalty, and we want to go march against the death penalty, and you got to make up your mind how we're going to allocate the budgetary resources this year. And you may have an opinion about which of those is the pro-life cause you want to be involved in or should be involved in. Here comes the pastor, and he says, I'm the decider, and I decide for blank.
Yeah.
Well, religious submission in mind and will doesn't mean, well, I think the pastor made the right decision. What if he makes the call for the group I don't like? It doesn't mean I have to agree with him. It just means I have to go, well, he's a pastor and I'm not, so I guess that's where the money's going.
Exactly.
That's religious submission, and then I'm not, and then I accept that. He gets to set the policy. It doesn't mean I have to think the policy's right.
Okay. And I'm very glad for your PS, David. Thanks for adding that nuance there is very important.
Thank you.
Lawrence, thanks again for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you call now, we can get you on the air. 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews. We're live on this Wednesday afternoon here on EWTN. Let's go to Denise in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening online, EWTN.com. Hello, Denise. What's on your mind today?
Hi, I'm reading the book of Eusebius, the historian of the early church. And there, in his first book, he talks about a letter that he received that was sent by Toparch Abgar of the city of Edessa to Jesus. And Jesus sent him, Abgar wants to be, has heard of Jesus and wants to be healed by Christ. But Christ is in his last of his mission. And so he supposedly wrote a letter back to Abgar saying he would send his apostle Thaddeus to heal him. And this subsequently happens according to Eusebius. So I'm wondering, is that true? Can we believe Eusebius in this matter?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. I think modern historians are almost universally agreed that the purported letter correspondence between Jesus and this Armenian king is legendary and is not historical. So when you ask me the question, you know, ought I to believe it or should I believe it or could I believe it? So, you know, Catholics have an obligation to assent to truths of reason.
Sure.
And I mean, and granted, historical reconstruction isn't the sort of thing that permits of absolute certainty. But, you know, the laws of probability can weigh heavily one way or the other. And I think it's disingenuous and a bit ignorant to say, well, I want this story to be true, therefore I will construe it as true, you know, period, in fact, without qualification. You know, ignore evidence to the contrary. So I don't think that's necessarily a rational position to take. What I would do instead is something like this. So let's say there's some document from the Christian past that I have strong reason to believe is legendary and probably not founded in history.
Uh-huh.
What it is absolutely true is that it reflects the piety of the author and likely the community from which he wrote. And that's historical.
Yes.
Right? That's historical. And so I can say, you know, I'm highly sympathetic to the piety of this particular Catholic community, to the way they construed the world, to the way they understood their relationship to God. And that's part of the Catholic patrimony. And so I can identify with their way of being in the world and with the piety that they practiced without necessarily thinking that the legends they invented are veridical.
Sure.
And so I can kind of have my cake and eat it too there.
Yeah. Does that make sense to you, Denise?
Yeah, I'm just trying to catch up on all this stuff, coming back to the church, and I'm just trying to parse what to believe and what not to believe. And
oh, well.
I thought it was kind of wild, but, you know, so I'm asking you.
Yeah, well, let me help you out there with the what to believe and what not to believe business, because that's actually much easier to answer. So when we make an act of faith in the Catholic Church, what we pledge to believe are the dogmas of the faith. And those are defined, and you can find them more or less spelled out in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, right? Uh-huh. That's the content of the faith that we assent to. Now, beyond that, you know, the Catholic Church as an institution, as an historical reality, is 2,000 years old and contains just a vast sum of human experience, all of which is available to us for our edification and reflection and sometimes for our humiliation, you know, if we are ashamed of what Catholics have done in the past. But
yeah.
one way or the other, it all belongs to our patrimony. This is our family, you know, the Catholic Church. So we can embrace all that as the family history. And we should study it and learn about it. But in terms of our act of religious faith, that's pretty much restricted to the dogmatic teaching of the church. And that's a very manageable number of things that we actually have to believe. And beyond that, you know, we can use our critical reason and you know, try to live well in the world together. But in terms of what do you have to believe, you just have to believe the dogmas.
Thanks again for your question today, Denise. We appreciate hearing from you in Lincoln. A quick question as we're heading to break here, and this is coming from, let me scroll down a little bit here, click. There we go, V. V on YouTube says, this is a Jubilee year, but do Catholics normally go to Jubilee every year?
No. Jubilees are not annual events in the Catholic Church.
Not a thing.
Yeah, not a thing.
But it is what, every 25 years?
You tell me. That's about right, isn't it?
I think so. And the idea is that you participate in some way with, you know, something that, you know, like, for example, going through a holy door.
There you go.
And things of that sort.
So, you know, I have been a Catholic for, 22 years now, I think.
Uh-huh.
So I'm a baby Catholic who's only old enough to have done one of these.
Yeah.
So I'm not yet used to the pattern.
I've only done a couple myself, so I know where you're coming from. V, thanks so much for your question. Glad that you're watching us today on YouTube. When we come back, we're going to get that question from Jack watching on YouTube today. Jack has a question about everybody's favorite pope, Pope Joan. So we're going to get into that. And there's also lines available for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you'd rather text us, you can do it. Text the letters EWTN to 58177. Back in a moment with lots more of the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call to EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We are live on this Wednesday. The phone number 833-288-EWTN. Maybe you'd like to explain to us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. We'd love to talk about that. 833 888-288-3986. Congratulations going out to another great EWTN radio partner celebrating 15 years with us, the great Red Sea Catholic Radio. They have four radio stations serving Bryan College Station, Hearn, Lorena, Waco, and Palestine, Texas. Congratulations to Dennis Maka and everybody there at Red Sea Catholic Radio from your friends here at EWTN. I wonder if that's Palestine. It may not be Palestine. I believe that's in Ohio.
Okay.
I need to look that up. We're going to get back to the phones in a moment, but first that question from Jack on YouTube, who says, Dr. Anders, can you speak to the legend of Pope Joan? Is there any validity to this legend? And if not, how did the thing come up in the first place?
Right. So the legend of Pope Joan is a legend that emerges for the first time in the 13th century, alleging that there had been a pope between the reigns of Leo IV and Benedict III, which does not show up in the historical record, I might add,
okay,
of about 2 years, where the holder of the papal office was actually a woman who had passed herself off as a man. So that would be that was the legend. Now, it's not true. There's no basis for it in history. But if it were true, what significance would that have for the Catholic faith? Absolutely none. All that would mean is that we had a 2-year interregnum.
Ah.
Right. We had a set of vicontes. We were the see of Peter would have been empty for those 2 years, and then, you know, followed by the legitimate election of a valid pontiff. Because a woman cannot be ordained a priest, and of course the Bishop of Rome is the Pope, that is the Bishop of Rome, who must by definition be a priest, so you cannot ordain a woman to that position. If you said the words and did the gestures, it would just be shooting blanks. Nothing would happen. and so if it were true, which it isn't, it would have no significance other than the fact that somebody had managed to hoodwink the Roman people and the clergy, and you'd had a 2-year interregnum, and any deeds that were taken, that were performed in that pope's name, would be null and void because they wouldn't have any legal force, right? It'd be like if I show up in Washington and try to pass myself off as the president, right? I mean, like, I wouldn't be taken seriously, but if I managed to convince some cohort that I was, in fact, the lawful president, any actions that I took would be null and void and have no legal force after the fact, right? So it's the same sort of idea. But no, there is no basis for the legend, in fact. And where did it come from? Well, you know, one thing that is characteristic of the 13th century is a lot of religious controversy. And there was, beginning really in the 12th century, a popular movement, and some historians sometimes just call it the religious movement, right, of the Middle Ages. Herbert Grunemann has a great book on the topic, just simply called The Religious Movements of the Middle Ages, of essentially a sort of populist, maybe it's more similarity to the modern political environment, kind of a populist uprising against clergy and episcopal and papal authority.
Uh-huh.
And it took many different forms. Sometimes it was, you know, wildly heretical, like in the case of the Albigensians that held to essentially Manichaean or Gnostic doctrine and believed positions just wildly at odds with Catholic orthodoxy. Other times it would be sort of more morally mainstream, metaphysically mainstream, something like the Waldensians in Lyon, France, who simply advocated for popular preaching and poverty, that sort of thing. And then sometimes it would be more sort of within the heart of the church itself. So if St. Francis, when he began his Reformation, at first glance seemed a lot like these other popular reformers that were sometimes deeply anti-clerical, because, you know, he lived this sort of radical life that seemed to be a kind of contradiction to the worldliness of the clergy. And so he was looked at askance by members of the clergy and the hierarchy until it became apparent that he was actually deeply, deeply loyal to that very same hierarchy and utterly determined to obey the Pope and everything. And so Pope Innocent said, well, you know, if you can't beat him, join him. And he basically authorized Francis's unique form of life, which was an innovation at the time. And the Franciscan movement got started. And after Francis, the floodgates were opened and you began to see a whole host of religious orders popping up. Now, just because the Pope authorized them doesn't mean that there was no tension between the religious orders and, as it were, the mainstream Catholic hierarchy and clergy. In fact, there was quite a bit of animosity. And the secular, what they call the secular clergy or the diocesan clergy, were deeply resentful of the religious orders for a lot of reasons, not the least of which was they made the secular clergy look bad.
Really?
Yeah. And so they started circulating a lot of nasty rumors about the religious. And sometimes the rumors were, in fact, true. So there were some sort of far left-wing elements of the religious orders, even the Franciscans, that ended up going off into heresy. It was a group called the Spiritual Franciscans that ultimately ended up being anathematized and cast out of the church. And they held a lot of sort of crazy end-of-the-world apocalyptic theories. And it's actually they, rather than the Lutherans, that thought up the idea that the Pope was the Antichrist.
Really?
Right. Comes out of the spiritual Franciscan tradition.
Wow.
Right? And so religious criticism of the secular clergy and secular criticism of the religious clergy was a live thing in the 13th century. And one of the most amusing, to my mind, responses to that was by St. Thomas Aquinas, who wrote a defense of the religious orders against the attacks by the secular clergy. And I've read that, and the one thesis that stuck out in my mind, one of the criticisms of the religious by the seculars was that they preached too well. That religious preaching was too good. And St. Paul had said, you know, I come to you not with words of human wisdom, but you know, with the demonstration of the Spirit's power, you know, and I don't speak like a, you know, not a great speaker, whatever. And so they said, see, if this were really of God, they wouldn't speak so well. And so Thomas actually had to write a defense of good preaching.
It's funny,
right? But in this environment, I mean, all kinds of crazy accusations and urban legends got circulated on both sides. And so to me, it's not at all surprising. These were the tabloids of the 13th century,
man.
Right? It's not at all surprising to me that a religious thinker, by religious I mean someone from one of the religious orders,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And it came out of the Dominican order, I think, could advance a theory that would seem to cast shade on the papacy,
yeah.
Right? And of course, there was a passion for this kind of stuff, so it became quite popular, and it got widely circulated. As you can imagine, I mean, if somebody could credibly create, well, we don't do that today. There's like fake news. That's not a thing.
If somebody
could sort of credibly convince a segment of the population that something scandalous happened in the centers of power, that wouldn't get any traction today, right? But it had great traction in the 13th century. So the legend stuck around for a while. And then there were Renaissance figures. With the advent of the Renaissance and better methods of historical criticism began to look at this and say, is there any basis for this, in fact? And there was a Catholic polemicist and humanist scholar named Florimond de Raymond. And I know about him, actually. I actually read him when I was doing my doctoral dissertation, because he offered some intransigent criticisms of Calvinism in France in the 16th century, which was how I got into him.
But wow.
I think he was the first person to actually apply the tools of historical criticism to the Pope Joan legend and conclude that there was no basis for it, in fact.
All right. Pope Joan, not a thing.
A thing in legend. It's a medieval urban legend.
Okay.
But no historical Pope Joan.
Very good. Jack on YouTube, thanks for watching us today, and thanks so much for your question. Yeah, I think we get a Pope Joan question about once every 3 or 4 years. We take care of it. We move on with our lives.
There you go.
That's what you got to do. Hey, it's Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call. We can get in a few more here at 833-288-EWTN if you have a question for Dr. David Anders. 833-288-3986. Joe is watching us on YouTube today. Joe says, at Mass, why do we have year A, year B, and year C in the readings? I have seen them, but it's never crossed my mind to ask. I just took it for granted.
Well, you know, if you'd like, we could triple the length of the readings at Mass.
Oi.
We could get it all in a year. You want to do it that way?
Maybe not.
Yeah, okay. That's why.
So that's how
it
works.
It's just to split it up.
It's a rotation.
Yeah, it's just a rotation.
There you go. Here's a question now from Olivia. Is there a point where we are beyond forgiveness and cannot utilize confession anymore? I find myself despairing, sometimes even after confession.
So the point at which you are beyond forgiveness is the point at which you are impenitent, you're not sorry for your sins, and you fully intend to continue them. And you don't want to be reconciled to God. And that condition perdures as long as you continue to want to sin. You're not penitent, and you don't want to be reconciled to God. But the minute you're penitent, and you want to change, and you want to be reconciled to God, you're well placed to go to confession.
Okay.
So the only time the priest will deny, well, not the, the main time the priest would deny absolution is if you go in and you're not sorry.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a pretty low bar. How does the priest assess whether you're sorry? Well, it's a pretty simple test. You say, I'm sorry. Now, does it ever happen that someone goes to confession and they say, I did X, I did Y, I did Z? And the priest says, well, are you sorry? And the person answers, well, for X and Y, but not Z. The priest will say, well, I can't absolve you unless you're sorry for Z. Well, sorry, Father. I'm really not sorry for Z, and I'm going to go do Z again. Well, then I'm sorry I can't absolve you. That does happen. That does happen. But not very often, as you can imagine.
Probably not for
Olivia.
If you
make it into the confessional, odds are you want to amend your life.
Yeah, probably for Olivia, if she truly is, you know, sorry for her sins, and she makes a good confession, that's where you got to leave it, right?
Yeah, so let me address this whole, like, I keep doing the same thing and beating myself up over it thing, right?
Yes.
Here's one thing that both the Catholic faith and modern psychology teach us.
Uh-huh.
Willpower is a vanishing resource and is not a very effective instrument for change, honestly, right? Because we can outwit ourselves. And there's a part of our personality and our neurology that is just inclined to do things that are self-destructive. And so what you have to do is, in modern terms, you have to kind of hack your own neurology. In classical Catholic terms, you have to eliminate whatever leads you to sin. Right. And that's actually in the act of contrition, right? So like, I promise to sin no more and do penance, sin no more, and avoid whatever leads me to sin.
Yeah.
And for me personally, I'll just tell you, that's the one that I know is the most effective and the hardest to do. Because what we want to do is not change anything about our life and then steel ourselves with the conviction that, hey, the next time I'm faced with this temptation, I'm not going to give in. But we don't do anything to reduce the likelihood of being faced with that same temptation. And then we get faced with the same temptation, and we go, oh, that's right, I resolve not to do that. Grip my teeth, clench my fists, I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to do it. Oh, heck, I'm going to do it. Like, that's the pattern that most people have.
Yeah.
And the solution to that is twofold. Number one, you have to put yourself in situations where you're not going to be faced with that temptation.
Sure, sure.
Right? And that means you have to reorder your life, and sometimes in uncomfortable ways. You know, you empty the liquor cabinet, throw away your telephone, whatever it is, right? We don't want to do those inconvenient things, but that's step number one, right? And then step number two is you have to positively institute new habits in your life that will orient your thought, your affections, your emotions, your imagination towards more positive and edifying aims. Right, that's the point of devotions.
Yeah.
Now, you don't have to do any particular devotion, but like one of the major objectives in having a prayer life is so that I'm saturating my mind with different content. And you know, one thing that we know now from the world of neuroscience is how much of our thought processes are in fact unconscious. And you know, some of the experiments that have been done with like split brain patients and also with like subliminal messaging, you flash a word on the screen, but then a split second before you flash, you know, just a millisecond of a contrary message, and so it's entering your brain, but in a way of which you're not conscious.
Yeah.
And those kind of experiments have revealed that it is definitely possible to influence people's behavior and their thoughts in ways that they're not conscious of.
Like
we're really, really subject to influences that we pick up implicitly around us.
Wow.
You're not the master of your thoughts the way you think you are. And knowing that going in advance, like this is why, say, something like monastic discipline was developed, right? Because the idea was, let me construct an environment in which I'm constantly reinforcing at a subliminal level the right messaging. So that I'm not just consciously trying to change my thoughts. I'm setting up an environment where I'm going to be unconsciously changing my thoughts all the time, and meditating day and night on the law of the Lord, as it were, to quote the psalmist, so that it will ultimately have an effect in the way that I value things, in the way I respond to stimuli, et cetera, et cetera. This is why the sacraments. St. Thomas talks about this. Like, why not just abstractly teach, hey, die to yourself and be born again in Jesus, and then God activates that with grace. Why not do it that way? Why not just make an admonition that we change? Why back it up with a ritual that is essentially nonverbal, right?
Yeah.
And Thomas tells us it's because of the nature of our neurology. Now, Thomas doesn't have the concept of neurology as such, but he definitely has a concept of human psychology embedded in our animal nature. And he says, the reason God gave us sacraments is that God's a good pedagogue who is sensitive to learning styles, and we need tangible points of contact so that we can embed and embody these truths in ways that are not purely discursive, that work on our psychology, our subconscious, our affectivity, you know, actuated by grace, of course, and the supernatural, but the mode of instruction, the sacramental mode, the ritual mode, is meant to be specifically adapted to our psychology. In a way that, so it's just mere willpower is not.
Olivia, thanks so much for your email. It's called A Communion here on EWTN. Coming up on most of these EWTN stations next, and that'll be at 3 p.m. Eastern. It is Open Line Wednesday with our own Father Mitch Pacwa. That's coming up in about 15 minutes or so, again, on most of these EWTN stations at 3 p.m. Eastern. Right now, let's go to Joe in Birmingham, right here in town, listening on the Great Guadalupe Network, AM 1480. Hello, Joe. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, sir. I'm Catholic, and I've been a Catholic all my life. I've practiced my Catholic faith. I'm not perfect in any way. But lately, with all the current stuff that's happening in the news between Israel and the Middle East, really, I'm very upset and disheartened about the way the Catholics are choosing to view this. From what I've read on several things is that they've taken the side of the Israelis and the Jewish people rather than on the Christian side.
It's very
upsetting to me.
Well, I appreciate that a lot. So there are Catholics in Palestine, there are Catholics in Gaza, there are Catholics in the West Bank, there are Orthodox Christians in those places, and there are, of course, people in those situations that are not religious of any kind, right? There are Muslims, of course, that live in those territories. Some of them are allied with radical Islamic terrorist groups, and many of them, most of them, in fact, are not, right? And so I agree with you. It is a mistake for people in the West to caricature the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as if it were simply a battle between, you know, two religious groups, one of which we might be inclined because of our religious predilections to demonize in some way. That's, again, I always talk about how ideological positions are procrustean. They tend to lop off the bits that don't fit. And the stereotype of, you know, the Islamic terrorist who's at war with Israel ignores the vast majority of Palestinian people that don't fit that description, right? And as to the question, you know, at least there's at least some Catholic prejudice, I think, in this instance, that would be motivated by those kind of concerns. I mean, there are others that might have a more principled preference, you know, geopolitically for Israel or whatever in the way they construe the conflict. But the underlying message is clear that, like, political policy and ideology definitely skew how we interpret human conflict. And that's true whether you are, whichever side of the conflict you take. I remember once, years ago, when I first was a kid and I hadn't really any awareness of geopolitics, I was a high school student, and someone organized a debate on the campus between a Palestinian and Israeli citizen. And they both happened to be parents of kids in the school. It was kind of an international school. And they were both highly educated men that engaged in the debate. And I'm a 16-year-old American with a head full of mush who knows nothing about the Middle East. And I remember I listened, I can't remember which side went first, but let's just say it was the Palestinian.
Okay.
Palestinian fellow went first. No, I do remember it was the Israeli that went first. Israeli fellow went first. And I listened to his presentation. I thought, my gosh, that's just, he's right. I mean, this thing is just terrible. I mean, the Israelis have just really been put upon, and they have every right to do whatever they do. And the way they construe this thing just can't possibly, no rational person could see this in another light. And then after a few minutes, you know, the Palestinian fellow got up, and he's also a highly educated and articulate person. And I listened to him, and I thought, oh, my gosh, these people have been terribly put upon, and this is a horrible injustice, and there's absolutely no way out of this. And how could any rational person not see the thing from their point of view? And then the light bulb went off, and it went, aha.
The last great argument.
This is an intractable problem.
Sure.
Right? And it's entirely possible to construe any kind of political conflict like this from different points of view, right? And they seem entirely justifiable to the person who takes the position, to the partisan, right? And knowing that about human persons, right, whenever we engage in any kind of conflict, we need to, I think, ultimately, like Christ did, be hyper-focused on the persons. Hyper-focused on the persons. And however we might construe any particular conflict ideologically, we cannot be comfortable with the, as it were, collateral damage of our ideology. Some humans are going to suffer terribly. And we cannot whitewash that or brush it under the rug. You know, we can't say, well, you know, it doesn't matter that I took out, you know, 17 hospitals and killed, you know, 3,000 Palestinian babies because I went after the terrorists. And I also can't say, well, it doesn't matter that, you know, Jewish women and children were taken hostage or tortured and raped in terrible, horrible ways by Hamas guerrillas. Well, because Israel's done terrible things. Like, you can't do that. You cannot justify injustice by pleading some higher end, right? That's just not the way to do business. And these things are difficult, and they do require experience and prudence and life on the ground. And I think we would do well, as Catholics, to heed what our co-religionists have to say who do live on the ground in these cultures and say, look, the way Western media is portraying these conflicts is not true at the personal level, right?
Yeah.
Now, I'm far from telling you I know how to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, right? I, of course, don't, and I don't even pretend to, right? And thank God I'm not a policymaker. But your frustration is appreciated.
Joe, thanks so much for your call. I'm glad you're listening to the Great Guadalupe Radio right here in Birmingham. We got an email, David, from Liam, who says, what does Daniel 2, verse 44, what does that mean? We're talking here about the king's dream about the giant statue made of different metals. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So most biblical scholars, this is written, the Book of Daniel is probably written in the Maccabean period, maybe 2nd century BC.
Okay.
But it's written as if it took place during the Babylonian exile. So it's a look back kind of thing.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
And it's a historical retrospective written from the point of view of someone in the Babylonian exile. But it reflects geopolitical developments that were already contemporary with the actual writer who lives in the 2nd century. So there's multiple descriptions in the Book of Daniel of the rise of Babylon, the fall of Babylon to Persia, and the fall of Persia to Alexander the Great's conquests, and ultimately to the rise of the Seleucid Empire, that would be so oppressive to Jewish people in Jerusalem and try to outlaw the practice of the Jewish faith and temple sacrifices, that would ultimately lead to the Maccabean revolt. So all that's in view in the Book of Daniel, but it's written in this apocalyptic narrative style, you know, as if it were written, proleptically during the period of the Babylonian exile.
Liam, thanks so much for your email. We have time for this one from Kevin. I am a Protestant, and in the Hail Mary, you call Mary the Mother of God. Can you help me understand this more?
Yeah, thanks. So just so you know, Martin Luther would have hailed Mary as Mother of God. John Calvin would have did hail Mary as Mother of God. Cranmer, the head theologian of the Anglican tradition, would be very comfortable with the title Mother of God. When I was in the Evangelical Protestant Seminary, with the biggest bunch of Catholic-hating fundamentalists you've ever seen in your life, the well-informed Protestant theologians with whom I studied who really couldn't stand Catholicism, I mean, like with a fiery passion, the Pope is the Antichrist kind of people. I mean,
wow.
These folks were very deeply anti-Catholic bunch, hailed Mary as the Mother of God. I'm not a Baptist. My seminary was not a Baptist seminary, but we had a bunch of Baptists running around, and I had systematic theology with a Baptist. And I used a Baptist theological textbook. So I think it's Baker Bookhouse published Miller J. Erickson's Systematic Theology. And Erickson was a well-known Southern Baptist theologian. Let me tell you something. Erickson had no love for the Catholic Church. And I distinctly remember in our discussion of Christology, the Marian title, and of course the ecumenical councils, particularly Ephesus, that dogmatically declared Mary to be Mother of God. And Miller J. Erickson and all the informed Baptist theologians with whom I studied fully endorse that, right? So there's from the point of view of Christian orthodoxy and Trinitarian orthodoxy, there's nothing controversial about this title, right? It's not a uniquely Catholic or Orthodox title. It's something that any well-formed Protestant theologian also holds, okay? Why is that? Well, it fundamentally, it's not a doctrine about Mary so much as it is a doctrine about Jesus. Because there was a patriarch of Constantinople in the 5th century named Nestorius, who was uncomfortable with the title, which was ancient. And he said, you know, this kind of gives the impression that Mary gives birth to the Godhead, that somehow, that, like the parturition of God, that somehow she's birthed God in the sense that, you know, God didn't exist and suddenly Mary gives birth to him. It seemed to make Mary into some sort of divine figure and really reduce God to the level of a creature. And that's your intuition. That's what your gut's telling you, like, this is problematic for you. He said, well, we'd be better off referring to her as the Mother of Christ, not the Mother of God. But the church said, and the theologian said, and the council said, well, what you've just done in consequence is you have so separated the divine and the human in Jesus that it's like they've become two different people. And now you've taken the humanity of Christ and made it into like a unique person to whom Godhead is sort of attached as an adjunct that could come or go, as it were. And what we need to be able to do is say of Jesus Christ, he is God, right? And that means if I reach out and touch Jesus' hand, I'm touching the hand of God. Yes, God has a human hand in the person of Jesus, right? And if you can do that, if you can predicate godhood of the person Jesus, then obviously Mary being the mother of God is a logical consequence. Doesn't mean Mary's not a creature. She's still a creature. God's not a creature. But it's the way we have to speak to preserve the unity of the person of Christ in the two natures.
Kevin, thanks for your email. Dr. David Anders, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
See you next time. God bless.